down. Got me running round in circles, grinning upside down. Everybody have their high waders on tonight? You are to be commended for braving the storms. So glad to have y'all here. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And our speaker is Alex D. from the North Cobb Covenant Group. I think I met Alex at the Marietta Roundup. He did a presentation that was really good. And I thought he would be really good at telling you about his program. So I have high hopes. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you guys are here tonight. My name is Alex. I'm an alcoholic. And I do appreciate you guys coming out, despite the weather conditions. I don't know. He's got high hopes already, so we'll have to see. I'll do my very best. I wanted to start by saying what I usually start with is I realized pretty early on in my recovery that my brain just doesn't work the way normal people's brains work, or normal people, non-alcoholic people. I learned that pretty fast in my recovery. A couple quick examples of that, and then I'll get to my whole actual story. Just the way my brain works, I've been self-employed most of my life, was pretty confident in my capabilities, and I always had a lot of keys to carry around. I had keys to my businesses, keys to my house. For the young people that are here, our cars used to have two keys. Young people don't understand that, but they used to have two different keys. So I had a whole bunch of keys on a key ring because I was a very important person. I drank all the time, every day, all the time. I had my keys arranged on multiple rings, and along with all the keys, there were the other essentials, a bottle opener, a roach clip, you know, all the stuff you need to have on a key ring. Have them right at hand. I had them arranged in such a way that if I held the bottle opener, the ignition key to my van would be the very bottom one. My reasoning for that is no matter how wasted I was, I could find my key to drive. To me, that was brilliant. Like, smart thinking. No matter how trashed I was, I could not have to fumble around. I could find the key to my van and get on the road. Didn't think anything about endangering myself or other people. Another odd thing my brain thought was smart was, as I said, self-employed. And as an example, I had a studio. I've been a professional photographer most of my life. Had a studio in Dallas, Texas, which is where I sobered up, and I'll get to that part of the story. Had a successful business right on Central Expressway in Dallas. My store hours, my studio hours posted right in the door, always started at 10:15 because the liquor store didn't open until 10. I had to have time to get to the liquor store, and then get to work. So I couldn't open my shop at 10. You know, I was in the liquor store parking lot at 10. That, to me, was also logical, rational thinking. And then the last one that really kind of hit home with me is when so many people told me I really had a major problem, major drinking problem, major drug problem. They said, Alex, this is going to really mess up your life. You should really stop. My rationale to them was, it's not going to mess me up at all. I've got this under control. In fact, at that time, I had lived in or worked in 44 states of this country. I had only been to jail in 3. To me, I'm obviously in pretty good shape. You know, obviously nothing's really wrong here. Of course, that part of the story didn't include that 2 of those 3, Texas and California, multiple times each. I lost count of how many times I went to jail in California. I honestly don't remember. In Texas, I think it was only 3. Anyway, so to me, that's how my brain worked. That was how I rationalized the fact that I'm okay. I do not come from a line of alcoholics. A lot of people do know that alcoholism is frequently a family disease and a disorder. I'm a trendsetter in my family. I'm the only one that became an alcoholic and drug addict. Following recovery, I'm also the only one in my family to ever be elected the mayor of the city he lives in. I've been setting trends in a lot of different directions. But anyway, I was raised by a healthy, intelligent family. I was born in Boston. I was raised in upstate New York and northern New York. When I was very young, my father was a NASA engineer. And so the joke in our family was, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, but let's go ask him anyway. And my mother was a university professor. So I had intelligent people involved in my life. That didn't matter. Alcoholism didn't care. I have been well educated. I've said many times I've been educated beyond my intelligence. I am the youngest of 3. I had an older sister and an older brother. Now, as I mentioned to a friend before I got started, my brother and I are the only 2 left. My folks and my stepmother have passed on. My sister is deceased. My brother and I are still kicking around. But the funny thing was, when I was growing up as a teenager and I was experimenting, I was doing a lot of stuff as a teen like a lot of people do, my siblings, my older siblings, to me, they were just weird. My sister never drank. She just didn't like it. I thought, how can you not like that? My brother, he considered himself, and still does to this day, considers himself a pretty normal stand-up guy. He likes to have a cocktail after work. A cocktail. I've never had a cocktail in my life. Never had one drink. My brother is also, I give him a hard time. He's the kind of guy that I'd go out and buy a case of beer like for the summer, you know. And I'd be going, what are we doing after dinner? I mean, that's not going to last. Anyway, I wasn't like them. Although I was raised, as I said, raised in a very healthy family, raised well. I'm a descendant of a long line of snobs because I didn't really realize, you know, that we had it pretty good. To me, that was just normal. You know, we had a good life and it was normal. I was very sick when I was about 6 or 7 years old. I had hepatitis of some letter that took me out of commission for several months. This was back, of course, in the 60s, so the medical advancements aren't then what they are now. Anyway, so it sort of stunted my growth. I was very small. I am still a very fairly narrow person. I've never been a big person. I didn't actually grow until I was 19 years old. I was the second to the shortest person in my high school. Now I'm about 6'2". I used to be 6'3" when I was a little younger. I say that to say that I also got picked on a lot in school because I was just a little kid. I was an art geek and a band geek and a nerd and not an athlete, and so I got in a lot of crap with a lot of people. I found my way to popularity or get a little group of people, especially in my later years in high school and certainly in college, by being one of the partiers, one of the partying kids. That kind of got me into a different circle than just being a loner. Side note that I'll try to get through quickly, my siblings were both quite a bit older than I was. My sister was already out of college and on her way. My brother was going off to college when I was a middle teenager, 14 years old or so. My mother never remarried, but she met a man that she spent a lot of time with, actually the guy that got me started in photography, sort of a mentor of mine who also happened to drink a fair amount. And they moved to England right before I turned 15. So I started living on my own just before 15 years. She kept the house that we had, and I had a job after school, and I had side jobs, you know, shoveling snow or mowing grass, depending on the season, and I just wound up taking care of myself. I kind of learned early on that I could be, quote-unquote, just self-sufficient. I can take care of me. I don't need anybody else. I finished high school with honors. I went to got accepted at the university I wanted to go to, a fairly prestigious music school in New York. that too kind of took a big hit to the ego, because in this small town in upstate New York, I was kind of like the best musician in the school. I was doing well. I was kind of well considered there. I get to this college, and all of a sudden, it's like, well, these are people from all over the country. They were way better than I was. And so I felt kind of small. But there again, start being one of the partying guys and start bringing in a different circle of friends. I practiced drinking. I practiced partying. I practiced and worked on being one of the hardcore, I'm going to outdrink and outlast everybody here. Again, having had hepatitis when I was young, as I mentioned, my liver was already compromised. Didn't matter. I'm going to do it anyway. I kind of, as I said, I grew when I was 19, my freshman year of school. I went from about 5'2 to about 6'2. So I was still pretty, you know, nerdy and not super, athletic or anything like that. But I found that if I had booze and if I had other substances, people would want to come around. So I worked on that. And I worked on becoming one of the real, real drinkers. I mean, you just drink, you pass out, wake up, throw up, keep drinking. That's what I worked on. Somehow, after 5 years, I had my second degree. I have no idea how I made it through school drinking as hard as I did, but I did. I had always been interested in photography and even worked as the music school's primary photographer. Got to do some incredible things in my college career. Our music school provided all of the music for the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid. I had a full accreditation pass in the Olympics. I could go anywhere. I went to every event. I stayed in Lake Placid the entire 13 days. I had a ball. And just a neat experience. I got to do some great things, many of which I can still remember. Not all of them. Some of them are distant memories. As I said, really worked on both my musical business and my photography business. And I realized actually finishing music school, I could make a lot more money in photography than I could in the music business, especially right out of school. I managed to luck into a few studios out of New York and wound up focusing primarily in the fashion industry. So if you can imagine, here's this partying 25-year-old guy. I'm getting paid a lot of money to travel all over the place and take pictures of girls. I'm thinking, this is a pretty cool job. And it became very much a rock and roll sort of lifestyle. I was good at what I did. I would refer to it as God-given talent, although at that time, there was no God in my life. My family was not a religious or church-going family. I wasn't ever introduced to a church. I went on a couple of Christmases with some friends' families. Didn't think much of it. Really wasn't for me. I consider myself much too smart to need a spiritual life. I could take care of myself. I didn't need anything else. So that's why I refer to it now as a God-given talent. I don't know how the things I did happened, but they must have been a God-given gift. I just didn't know it at the time. As I said, I was good at what I did. I got paid a lot to travel. I got bought out of different studios. I went a period of several years without ever having to apply for work anywhere. I would have contracts lined up. I'd be working those contracts. I'd get called from a different studio. They would buy me out of the company I was working for. I mean, my ego just grew and grew. And at one point, one of the studios actually was going to be sold off. The managers called me in and said, hey, as one of our top guys, we need to let you know there's about to be a bunch of photographers looking for work in this area. So I started going outside that area a little farther with my massive ego, and I'd walk into some other places, and I'd walk in and want to speak to their owners or their managers, and I would say, I'm considering letting you hire me. And it worked. It worked, and it worked a few different times, and I thought, this is nuts. And it was, as I said, very much a sort of, it became a big thing. In the fashion industry, there's a lot of booze. There's a lot of drugs. And they would call me up, and they'd say, we're going to send you to Houston. You're going to shoot a sportswear catalog for such and such a company. It was in the 80s, did a lot of designer jeans. And they would say, what do you need when you get here? And I would say, well, I need at least one grip if it's inside, two if it's outside. That is, you know, guys that can help move lights and reflector panels and so on. Need at least one or two grips. Obviously, you know, the stylists, the wardrobe, makeup people. And I said, I would also need a bottle of Jack Daniels and a case of cold Canadian beer. And I would get to these assignments, and that stuff would be sitting there. I'd crack that bottle open and say, all right, let's go. Who's up first? What's going on? And it just became how I lived. It became what I did. And that somehow I survived that for many, many years. And a lot of run-ins with the law, as I said, just a lot of trouble. And it went from, I found myself relocating out to California, Southern California first, and went from out there, a stage in my life where literally if there was a young lady that I met, there were a lot of women in my life too. I had a lot of everything. I did find out what I'm really addicted to is more. I mean, whatever it was, if I had money, I wanted more money. You know, I had women, I wanted more women. I had booze, I wanted more booze. I had drugs, I wanted more drugs. Whatever it was, I had to have more of it. In Southern California, I went from the point, to make this a shorter story, of meeting a young lady that I liked, I'd usually buy them a car if I liked them. And I thought, hey, I might let this girl stick around a while. Here's a car. Went from that to running several successful businesses into the ground, or into my nose, depending how you look at it. And went from that point to the point of living in the attic above some guy's garage. Not a finished attic, plywood over insulation, and an extension cord for an alarm clock. It took me all the way down. I still kept this thought in my head, I can handle this, everything's still under control, everything's still okay, living in the attic above some guy's garage. It cunning and baffling and powerful. I mean, it was amazing. I had so many people tell me, you know, Alex, you've got to stop. You have got to stop. I said to another friend before we started, I never would have said to anyone that I was suicidal. But when friends would say, Alex, if you keep consuming that much booze and that much drugs, it is going to kill you. I would say, let's find out. I wouldn't stop. I wanted to find out. That is suicidal, by the way, but I didn't know it. I did go to one AA meeting in California because everybody kept griping at me and saying, you need something. You have to stop doing this. You're killing yourself. So I went to one meeting. Don't remember anything about it other than I walked in. I saw the rules, you know, that I thought were rules on the wall. I'm sure they said that they were 12 suggested steps. I didn't hear that. I saw rules. I saw God in them. I thought, oh, okay. This is for, you know, simpler people, you know, not geniuses like me, not people that are an artiste like I am, you know, not people of my level. I mentioned a bit of an ego problem I had. The drugs and the situations I got into were big. I was dealing at a high level. I mean, it was bad. When there was money, I mean, it was dealing with people directly from Colombia in mass quantities. And, I mean, and some of my clients were actually members of the Sacramento Police Department. And so when I would get arrested, they would, you know, things would magically happen and I'd walk, and that happened a lot. I finally got kicked out of California. I came in front of the same judge several times. And every time, you know, evidence was missing, something was done incorrectly, you know. And so finally he called me up to the bench one time when I was sitting in the back with my feet up, like just waiting. I knew I was walking out. Spent the night in jail. I know I'm going home. He called me up to the bench and he said, Mr. Damon, pardon me, I put my last name in there. He said, I know you're walking. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, I just want to let you know, I don't know what's going on yet, but I know something's going on. And I'm going to make it my personal goal to put you away. The next time I hear your name, parking ticket, jaywalking, he said, I don't care. I'm going to put you away. And I said, I'm thinking of moving. And he said, that's a really good idea. So I moved from California to Dallas, Texas, where my brother was living. He let me stay with him for a little while until he kicked me out of his house. Got an apartment in a little crack house type of place for a while. Anyway, you know, opened a business in Texas, and that did okay for a while. Then again, you know, the same thing happening over and over again. That's when, again, I wound up living in the attic above some guy's garage out there in Texas. My family actually got together from all over the world where they were living at the time. My father was living in the Caribbean. He'd remarried a wealthy woman. He was a very smart man. And my mother had moved back to the States, but she was still in New York. My sister was in, I believe, San Diego at the time. My brother, as I said, was in Dallas. They got together, as spread out as they were, and actually set up a good old-fashioned intervention and said, "Alex, you're dying. We can't stand this anymore. We've researched a whole bunch of different rehabilitation facilities. We've selected one that will let you and my brother and my father. We're footing the bill for this." They even had a little duffel bag, you know, all ready for me to go, the little rehab duffel bag, you know, sharp items, you know, all this stuff. They had it ready for me. And they said, "We need you to do this or we can't be a part of your life." And I said, "Screw you people. I'm out of here." And I walked out. And to this day, that's very hard for me to even fathom how that must have felt to them. My main reason for walking out is that little place I was staying. By this time, I was out of the guy's attic, and a couple of friends had let me crash at their place. They gave me just a bed to sleep on at that time. And I knew if I went back there, I had a few more drinks and I had a little bit more of other substances that I could partake in. That's why I really wanted to get back. So I went back there, finished what I had, somehow got up the nerve to call my brother the next morning and say, "Okay, take me in, you know." And on that ride to the facility, I was full of bravado and saying, "You know, it won't work. I went to that AA meeting in California. You know, I went to a meeting already. It didn't work. AA won't work. I went to a meeting. I spent a whole hour." And that had been several years prior, of course. So all the way in there, I'm telling him it won't work. And he's just sort of smiling and nodding. He's going, "Well, we're going to give it a shot." And, of course, inside, I was terrified. I had no idea what was going to happen. I was absolutely mortified. They take me to this place. And as I mentioned, I did come from a long line of snobs. I still said to that day, I didn't go to rehab. I went to a behavioral health center. So I was at this behavioral health center. Actually, it's Charter Hospital, pretty well-known place. They, of course, have to do an evaluation and intake. Some of you may have experienced that joy in your life. They take me back to see these doctors, and, of course, they're asking all these questions, and they're taking blood, and they're doing all this stuff, and I didn't have to tell them much. They had blood samples that they could tell. And I was still saying, you know, I'm fine. I don't need this. I'm just here because my family won't get off my back. I got the judge. I came in for back problems. You know, everybody was on my back. And the doctors said, "No, Alex, you're dying. Your body is disintegrating. You're dying." And I said, "Oh, you have to say that because you work at a rehab. I mean, you have to say it." And they said, "No, you're dying." 6'3" at that time. I weighed 128 pounds. My eyes were yellow. My hands shook like this. I mean, and I said, "I'm fine. I'm fine." And they're like, no. you're not fine. Just as comparison's sake, I'm about 185, 190 now. So 50-plus pounds skinnier than this. Not healthy. Not good. So I suffered through the rehab there. I just kind of hung on, you know, for the sake of hanging on. I'd go to these classes that they had. Didn't understand any of them. Didn't know what they were talking about. And they used to have to make us go to AA meetings from outside places. They'd bring in outside AA. And I thought, oh, God. You know, this is great. And so I'd go down there because I had to. Always sat all the way in the back. You know, just nothing against you guys sitting in the back, by the way. But, you know, always sat all the way in the back. And they bring in this old dude, salt and pepper beard, like I look now. I used to have hair. So they bring in this old dude, and he's telling his story, right? And I hear he's a truck driver. And I think, well, of course he needed this. He's just a truck driver. You know, I am an artiste. You know, the ego had not been addressed yet at all. So I'm sitting in the back listening to this truck driver, sort of listening. But I heard him say that he used to come to in various places across the country and go find a newspaper to find out where he was. And I thought, I've done that. I've done that a bunch of times. I've gone into a Denny's and like, where are we? You know, I would have no idea what part of the country I was even in. I'd get to assignments for these studios, and I'd start filling in my papers, and I'd be like, what town are we in? And frequently I have to ask what state after that. So anyway, this old truck driver hit a couple little things that I started going, huh, that's funny, you know. Then I started to actually notice, too, that he and a bunch of these folks that kind of came in with him and that were sitting around, they were all just laughing and having fun and carrying on. And I thought, wow, I can't even remember the last time I did that. I was just teeth clenched and just hanging on just every day. And that caught my attention a little bit. I stuck it out through the entire time at rehab, or I'm sorry, the behavioral health center. And went to outpatient treatment there. And then after a little while doing outpatient, then they let me drive the nut bus a few times, you know, to take people to meetings, the druggy buggy, whatever you want to call it. And I started taking people to meetings. I started watching my cohorts in outpatient just start dropping like flies. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. I mean, not yet. I mean, I know my brother and father just shelled out a lot of money for me to go through this. I'm going to at least try to ride this for a little bit. Didn't have any real plans. So I kind of started using the ego, kind of started using that to my defense, sort of. I thought, you know what? I'm gonna stick this out. I'm going to stick it out longer than that guy. And one of the guys in my outpatient thing was a doctor, I mean, like a physician. And I thought, well, I'm going to last longer. He goes, you know, I kind of got a little personal thing going. We were each going to just hang on longer than the other one. So I started really listening for a change and started paying attention to some other people for a change, which was a new thing for me. Still had a lot of problems with all the God stuff because I just felt I just didn't need it. Shortly after I may have still even been involved in the outpatient program, or maybe shortly after that, I'm not sure exactly. I was driving around North Dallas in Texas. I was trying to find a young lady that I met that came to one of the family sessions. Like, she was the sister of a guy I was in rehab with, and I knew, you know, she must want me. So I was trying to find out where she lived. I'm driving around, she may have given me a phony address. I mean, who knows? It could have happened. But I couldn't find her. I had a meeting schedule that somebody had given me. I had it there in my van. So I picked it up, and I realized there was a meeting at the Dallas North Group, like in, you know, 15 minutes right from where I was. And I thought, well, screw it. All right, if I can't find this girl, I'll just go to a meeting. It was a late-night meeting, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, candlelight meeting. And so I go in, sat in the back, and there's some guy up here chairing, and there's a couple of nerdy guys sitting right up front, you know, like I do. And by the time I was in the back. And it was also apparently what's called a tag meeting. I'd never seen one of those before. But whoever then shares picks the next person to share. So I'm just hanging out in the back, minding my own business. It's dark. The goofy guy sitting right up front here, after a while, he shared something. I don't know what he said. And then he goes, I want to hear from that guy. And he just points right at me, like all the way at the back of the room. And I'm like, okay. I said, well, my name's Alex. I'm an alcoholic. And I have no idea what else I said. No clue. Probably, I had no idea what they were even talking about. So I just sort of rode that out. After the meeting, that guy came up to me that was sitting there, asked me if I had a sponsor. And I said, no, don't have a sponsor. He said, well, you do now. I said, here's my number. You call me tomorrow. And I thought, that's kind of pushy. But, again, God's divine intervention, and that person, his name was Greg R. I believe he's no longer with us. I kept track of him for most of my recovery, but anyway, he knew. He just knew that if it was up to me and my ego, I probably wouldn't have done it. And I probably wouldn't have made it. I met with him every week. We read through this book cover to cover. He even let me kind of run through the steps the first time, like Alex's way. And then he said, okay, that was great. Now we're going to do what I did. And we went back through these steps and really, really through these steps in detail and in depth. He was an amazing man. And he asked me about my beliefs. And I said, well, you know, I don't really need the whole God stuff. I'll just skip that. And he said, well, that's probably not going to work really well for you. He said, for now, why don't you just believe that I believe? And I said, oh, sure. Okay, whatever. Because he knew if I gave it enough time, God's presence, my higher power's presence, would become so obvious that I wouldn't be able to deny it. And I can't. I cannot deny God's presence in my life. It's on the little page here, but I forgot to mention that when I did go through that rehab process, that was August of 1994. My sobriety date is August 18th, 1994. I actually went into the rehab on the 16th, but they basically put me in the psych ward and put me in a medically induced coma for 2 days, so I don't consider that part of my recovery, even though I didn't have anything to drink. Last time I had anything to drink or use was on the 15th, but I consider August 18th my sobriety date because that's when they moved me down to the chemical dependency unit, and I realized now I'm among my people. So the recovery hadn't obviously just been that one time through these steps. I continue to do that. I continue to do this today. The third step, I mean, for me, every morning I make that decision to turn my will and my life over. That's a daily thing for me. Just sort of in a nutshell, because I want to get to some of the service too. This, for me, this is not like written in the book as far as I know. I mean, I've never seen it. For me, the way these steps all break down is 1, 2, and 3 for me are about, I'm not going to drink anymore. I need to stop putting alcohol into my body. And for that matter, other substances too, but the booze was my main thing. 1, 2, and 3 is for me the method to start making that happen. I then take the next steps and kind of divide them into 3 sets of 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, 9, because they kind of do, you know, they kind of blend together. Those, they kind of follow logically one to the next. That middle set for me is really about living and not just not drinking. That middle set, steps 4 through 9, is really about how am I going to live now that I don't drink. And that's got the instructions in it. For me, 4 and 5 is about getting to understand myself, getting to understand what drives me, what makes this, what I thought was a great brain, which is not, how it makes this work the way it does. 6, 7 help me understand my higher power. They help me understand my God. And then 8, 9 help me understand other people, how to get right with other people, how to be a different person than the person that I used to be. And then what I really love about 10 and 11 is my very first sponsor and other sponsors since, as I have moved and picked up sponsors where I've been living. 10, for me, big underlined word is just continued. I mean, I've done these things. I've started to understand myself. I've started to understand God. I've started to understand how to live in the world with other people. 10, continued. Just keep doing it. But not to be satisfied with the status quo, 11, my big underlined words are sought to improve. So I'm going to do these things. I'm going to keep doing them. I'm going to seek to improve it. I'm going to try to keep making it better. And then 12, carrying this message and living by these principles in everything that I do, not just sitting in these rooms. It's pretty easy sitting in here. It's a lot tougher out there. Shortly after I managed to stay sober for a while, I met and married a lovely lady that I met. I was single all this time, all the way through. I had never married. Had some long-term girlfriends, like months. For me, that was long-term. But my home group in Plano, Texas, had big holiday celebrations where they'd have families come in and they'd have a speaker or something, but it was a clubhouse. They had huge meals and parties, and it was pretty cool. Anyway, I met one of those Christmas parties, and one of my buddies, Paul, was there. He'd been around forever. He knew everything in this book. He could quote pages. He's the guy that I went to. If my sponsor wasn't readily available, I'd go see this guy, Paul. He was a buddy of mine. And so anyway, I see this young lady there, and I know that's not okay. You know, you just don't do it. But I saw this young lady just smitten with her. So I go up to Paul and I say, hey, because he knew everybody. I said, Paul, who is that girl over there? And he said, oh, you haven't met my daughter. And I thought, well, she seems like a very nice young lady. I'm going to go home. See you later. So I left. Paul was at the next meeting the next night, as I was every night. And he called me over and he said, hey, Jessica, his daughter, who had just moved back in with him after leaving a previously bad relationship, he said, you know what? When we got home last night, he said, she was asking all kinds of questions about you. Why don't you come over to my place for dinner? She'll be making it, but why don't you come by for dinner? I said, okay. Anyway, less than a year later, she and I got married. So she and I have been married 27 years now out of my 29 years of recovery. Amazing lady. Absolutely amazing woman. Incredible woman. By the way, I do not recommend marrying somebody at 2 years sober. I do not recommend it. Likelihood of that working out is pretty slim. But anyway, we do live by the principles of this program. As I mentioned, my father had moved to the Caribbean when I was young. I used to go down there and just party like a madman when I was in the islands. I drank all day, every day in the States. I'd go down there and I'd just turn it up a few notches. So going down there sober was a whole new thing for me. First time I went back to the islands to visit my dad, I was 6 months sober. Went to a meeting at Hawk's Nest Beach on St. John, right on the beach, picnic tables under the palm trees. And I'm sitting there at this meeting, and I've been on this island since I was like 11 years old or younger. I mean, I knew my way around. I've been there dozens of times. I'm sitting in an AA meeting, Hawk's Nest Beach, Sunday morning, and I look up, and there's just this, like, cloud of butterflies, like, going up through the trees. The sunlight's coming in. Waves are coming in. And I think somebody was actually sharing during the meeting, and I just went, this place is beautiful. And, you know, people just started laughing, like, yeah, it is out. Keep coming back. You know, somebody else was talking at the time. But it just, like, dawned on me, like, oh, my God, I had missed it. I hadn't even seen it. I'd been there so many times. But anyway, I determined to get my own little piece of the tropical paradise, and I actually bought a house in the islands, moved my wife down there with me, and she had a little baby boy when I met her. He became sort of my instant family. We've had two girls since then, both of our girls born on St. John. I got my first GSR position down there. I went to a little meeting in Coral Bay, St. John, the most remote end of the smallest island away from the town. It's grown a lot since then, but the time was very small. I went to a meeting there. The guy was sitting, a buddy of mine, Fitz, was sitting at the table, and he said, so you moved down here, you bought a piece of property, are you going to live here year-round? And I said, yes, I am. He said, you're the new GSR. He said, I'm tired of this. You're the new GSR. And I was like, okay, cool, what's that? And he explained some to me, and I started going to St. Thomas for my my district meetings. And anyway, I wound up becoming the district chair in the Caribbean, which was pretty cool. And I got a chance to travel. Our meetings were in Florida. We were part of the South Florida district. South Florida, the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, and Antigua at the time. We had just voted Antigua in. I believe they've added a couple more. But so I got to travel up to Florida to take part in those state or area meetings. It was a really neat experience. It was very enlightening. I got to travel to other islands to help. I went to Antigua to help at the Crossroads Recovery Center that somebody, a famous guitar player, owns. And went there to help work with their counselors to help teach them about their traditions in AA. And one morning I got up, they put me up in a hotel in Falmouth Harbor, and I opened up my hotel room door out onto the beach, and I thought, this is service work. This is pretty cool. I like this. And luckily, it stuck in there, became the PICPC chair, public information and cooperation with the professional community chair in the Caribbean. And then all hell started breaking loose, pardon my terms. But my wife at that point decided she really wanted to move back to the States. Really wanted to. I really didn't want to. She had been from Enid, Oklahoma, where she was born, to Wichita Falls, Texas, to Dallas. I'd been, you know, all around the world. To get through as rapidly as I can, I mean, I still dug my heels in, and she finally came to me and said, the kids and I are going to move to the States. Do you want to come along or not? And I said, well, I'll get back to you. And I called my sponsor. I said, do you know what she's doing to me? You know, to me. And he said, and maybe it's not all about you. And then he said, what's more important to you, where your feet are or where your heart is? And I thought, oh, crap, I hate when they say stuff like that. So I went to my mom and said, okay, let's move. Where are we going? Are we moving to Western Oklahoma? I moved from the Caribbean, from tropical paradise, to Western Oklahoma, nowhere near Tulsa, Oklahoma City, Western Oklahoma. Did it sober, stayed sober through it. That's the little town where actually, in less than 2 years, I was the mayor of the town. Served 12 years, three terms there as mayor. Actually won the governor's arts award there. I was chair of the Mayor's Council of Oklahoma for a couple years. When I got to Oklahoma, we moved there in 2002. 2004, they had me chair the state conference. I went from meetings in Coral Bay, St. John, which had nowhere near as many people as this. We usually had four to maybe six of us. And all of a sudden, I'm chairing a meeting that has 1,700 people in it. And it was a blast. It was a cool experience. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it again, but it was a great thing to do. I have been very actively involved in service work ever since then. It's a huge part of my recovery. The little circle and triangle emblem that we have that you see all over the place here says unity, recovery, and service. Those are three things. It doesn't ever just say two things. The service foundation of what I've done has made my recovery so much stronger that I can't imagine not doing it. Right now, as of this month, I've just stepped down as GSR of a different group, and actually right now I hold no service positions. The first time, I think, in 20-plus years easily. I did serve as DCM of this region. I actually even served as the DCM chair for District 13 Atlanta, chaired the DCMs from all of our zones here. Any of you that don't know what that part is, please come see me after the meeting. I'd be happy to explain more how that part works here. It's a little different here than it is in several other states. The joy that I found in just simply following these steps and changing how I think. I mean, in step 12, too, it says having had a spiritual awakening. To me, that is, I have awakened as like a rebirth. I mean, I'm a different person. I'm not the same person that I was in August of 1994. I'm nowhere near that same person. I still have ego issues to work on. My sponsor will tell you that if he was here. I have life still issues to work on. But I follow the design that's in here, and it is actually referred to three times in here as a design for living. So much more than just not drinking anymore. A design for living. If I remember correctly, it's page 15, 28, and 81, I think it says that. Let's call it a design for living. The way that this works has made so much more work, so much beyond just staying, quote-unquote, on the wagon. Being sober is a good thing. Being in recovery is a critical thing. It's been an amazing journey. It says on page 164, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass. Great events have come to pass. The things I've gotten able, you know, my kids growing up being the mayor's kids, they thought that was pretty cool. I stopped running away from the police officers. They worked for me. I had friends of mine that were then like district attorneys, police officers, lawyers. They're friends of mine. I never would have imagined that. I still hate lawyers, basically, but luckily I haven't needed any in 29 years. I haven't needed a lawyer. It's been an amazing journey, and I love doing this right now. I love just hanging out and chatting with people before a meeting starts. I love going to a meeting, and I will actually sit there and shut up and not say a word, if you can believe that. But I'll do that because I love watching the light come on in people's eyes. When they come in and you say one little thing, like that old truck driver said to me, and the lights came on. And I thought, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can make it through this. And as of today, it's still my plan. Tomorrow, we'll start the day over and see what happens tomorrow. But more than likely, I'm going to keep doing this because this is what works. The promises are every one of them, hard and fast. There's no end to it. That's the other thing that I just absolutely love and I wanted to say. I'm not finished. I'm not in advanced AA. I do speak at several seminars and workshops. I do that sort of thing a lot because, A, I'm asked and I've learned to say yes when someone asks me to do something, but, B, I really enjoy making those connections. And I've made friends for life in here that are so far beyond my wildest dreams. And I didn't have to impress them with something that I had or something I could give them and make them feel better other than share the joy of dwelling in the realm of the Spirit. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. And that's about my time. So I appreciate you guys having me here. I'll be happy to chat with any of you later on, too. Thanks so much.
My sleep.